From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. One forecast for the 2018 hurricane season out of Colorado State University predicts 14 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes. That projection puts this year's activity at slightly above average. The official forecast from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, just came out literally an hour ago. Hurricane season starts June 1st, that's next week, and lasts through November 30th. There are new prediction tools this year that we'll learn about today, including estimated arrival times of, for example, tropical storm force winds. There's also a new storm surge tool that's operational this year. Generally, forecasts are getting better, error cones are shrinking, and storms are intensifying. Our guests today have lots of expert direction to offer regarding hurricane preparedness before, during, and after a storm. But one important point I suspect they'll drive home every chance they get: it only takes one major storm making landfall, and the time to prepare is now. With us today, Stephen Still. He's New Hanover County's Emergency Management and 911 Director. Stephen Still, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Weiss is a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Wilmington, which is a division of NOAA. Josh Weiss, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. Glad to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. How are you preparing for this year's hurricane season? Are you new to the area and to the idea of a hurricane season? What questions do you have about hurricane preparedness and response? Are you bored to tears by discussions about hurricane preparedness because you've ridden out every storm just fine and you think the media becomes the little red hen? Tell us about it. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Let's get right to this official hurricane forecast that just came out for 2018. Josh Weiss of the National Weather Service, what can we expect?
Well, good morning. Yeah, the official National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecast just came out, like you said, about an hour ago, and they are forecasting a 75% chance of normal to above normal Atlantic hurricane activity. The official numbers, they're forecasting 10 to 16 named storms. 5 to 9 of those may become hurricanes, and of those 5 to 9, 1 to 4 may become major hurricanes. In comparison, an average season in the Atlantic Basin would be 12 named storms, 6 of which become hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes. So an average to slightly above average season is in the forecast.
How does that compare to the unofficial forecast that Colorado State University put out?
Yeah, very similar this year. The Colorado State forecast, which came out back at the end of March, had 14 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes. So right in that same window that the National Hurricane Center is predicting for this season. So seeing those together makes for a pretty good forecast.
Stephen Still, how do most people die in severe weather events like hurricanes?
You know, that's a very good question. I think if we look at history, it's going to be storm surge. And that's what the National Weather Service is increasing, their confidence and their model guidance, and they're putting out new products. But I think in 2017, there was 0 deaths, provided that it was one of the strongest seasons we had ever seen. There was 0 deaths to storm surge. So
now, are you talking about North Carolina, New Hanover County? What?
Talking about nationally. So
nationally, yes, no deaths from storm surge.
No direct impacts attributed to deaths from storm surge, but we saw increases on indirect actions. So cardiovascular injuries, evacuation injuries, power restoration injuries, people doing tree removal.
Can you dive into that a little bit more? You say cardiovascular injuries, people have heart attacks during hurricanes?
Yeah, it's a very stressful time. If you can imagine, you're trying to take care of yourself and your family and your house. You're without power. You're without sanitation services, water, sewer. It can be very stressful. And if it's for a prolonged period, that just adds to your stress.
And you also talked about power outage or power line injuries?
Yes. Yeah, so individuals who are, not savvy with generators or power restoration, they pull out, gasoline power generators. They put them in areas, confined areas, where you're going to have carbon monoxide issues. And just actually transferring loads on generators and plugging things in adverse conditions where either it's raining, there's lots of injuries there.
So it sounds like you're saying that most deaths from hurricane types of events come after the storm.
That's what we're seeing just from this past season. You know, again, historically, it's been from storm surge. But this past year was a little bit of an anomaly. I just recently came back from the National Hurricane Conference in Orlando a couple of weeks ago, and Jamie Rome from NOAA was there. We asked that question, why do we have zero deaths from storm surge? And he said, and I think I'll quote, it was luck, chance, and geography. Just from where the storms hit, the timing, the locations, I think we just got lucky. For a while there, I thought that we were just doing a good job with our outreach, public media outreach, and our messaging and our preparedness stance. But I think luck had a lot to do with it.
But so NOAA's not going to let you take the credit for that.
I'm okay with that.
It's luck.
Well, if I can add one thing.
Sure.
Last year was the first year that we did the experimental storm surge watches and warnings.
Yeah.
Now, that will be going operational this year, but we were still producing those products last year. So people knew that there was a risk for significant storm surge, and that is water above ground level inundating homes and inundating the beaches. So I think having that additional product out there helped people really be aware of the threat and maybe get to safety when they needed to, whereas in previous seasons, they might not have, and that will definitely contribute to saving lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the products are great, but I think I'll say saturation, but you know, at one time, I think we had 5 advisories for tropical storms and hurricanes at one point in time, so the media coverage of it had a heightened sense of awareness, and so I think that helped. That helped people listen, that it drove it home, to see that there could be actually a hazard here.
Well, help us understand, for those folks who are new to the idea of a hurricane season, we throw terms around like storm surge, and you just said that it's water level above ground level. Was that the language you used?
Yes, that's the language we use.
Can you describe what it looks like and how it affects structures on the coast?
Sure. I think the best way to describe storm surge is to have somebody stand on their front yard who's near the beach and say, well, 3 feet of storm surge would mean that where you're standing in your front yard, which normally doesn't have any water in it, will now be up above your knee. That's the best way to describe storm surge. This is literally the ocean rising into your front yard, rising into your house. And when we say 3 feet above ground level, that's an inundation. That means that it will be 3 feet above where you're standing, above your knee, up to your thigh, whatever 3 feet is on an individual. That's what those numbers mean. So inundation is really the ocean rising into your house at some elevation above ground level, 3 feet, 6 feet. I think with Hazel, we had 18 feet in 1954 down in Brunswick County, and that's, you know, 3 times the average human being above your head. So that is what the storm surge is. It is water where it shouldn't be. It's the ocean where it usually isn't, and that is a very significant life-threatening inundation hazard.
And that's why scientists have worked to create this prediction tool that you said is operational this year. Stephen Still, can you describe what this storm surge tool, how it will work? And will regular folks have access to it, or will the information come through people like you?
Yeah, I believe National Weather Service, NOAA, they're looking to put this out for the widest dissemination possible, which I think is best. If people are looking at the same information that we are when they make those decisions for themselves and their families. But, you know, I think one thing, you know, Joss was mentioning is that storm surge has velocity to it. So it's not standing water, you know, inland flooding. Stormwater is rising. There's some velocity to the storm surge, especially on the immediate coast and in our estuarine and riverine areas. But these tools just drive it down at a smaller level. So I can look really neighborhood street-wise what I can expect in this geographic area. So before, it's really a wide swath that's painted across the map. And this is the area that we can need to accommodate for. But the newer graphics, I can almost tell that this exact street that we can anticipate having this much water. And so it truly helps with those evacuation decisions if I've got it to a street level, if I know there's maybe only one road in, one road out a particular neighborhood, and I can look at some adjusted products and say, this is an area of concern for us. And thankfully, we have this tool at this level of data, at this level that we could use.
And this tool was actually sort of beta tested last season, is that right? It wasn't really officially online. How did it do? How accurate was it? Josh Weiss?
I think that it did a really good job. You know, one of the things that the National Hurricane Center will do after every season is go back and evaluate their products. And while I don't have the official numbers on how it did, they wouldn't be going operational if they didn't see the significant benefit from it. They wouldn't be saying, well, it didn't do well, but we're going to go live with it anyway. They would spend another year, as you said, beta testing it, and then make it operational the next year. So while I don't have the official numbers, I know that it did well because we're going operational with it this season.
There's another tool that is sort of an estimated time of arrival tool. Stephen Still, can you tell us what new information that will give us?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most important things that we receive. When we have a storm approaching, you know, we have, even though it's a hurricane and we can see it tracking across the Atlantic, we have a limited amount of time to make decisions for the public that can be acted upon with some assurances. So we don't want to make an evacuation decision at night. So we're looking at the arrival of tropical storm force winds. When can we expect to see the arrival of those winds? And so if I know that it hits at this hour and it takes this many hours to evacuate these areas, that I have some reasonable assurance that I can get these people out of harm's way. The more detail I get on the arrival and, you know, when they leave, on those timings of winds, the better we are at making those preparative decisions.
So how far out then? Let's say there was a system in the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm going to give you this hypothetical when we come back. Actually, it may not be a hypothetical at this point. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a discussion about the 2018 hurricane season, how local leaders are preparing, how they want you to prepare, and what's new this year. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. If you have your own question for our experts, you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline at WHQR.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's a look ahead at the 2018 hurricane season with two local experts. Josh Weiss is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and Stephen Still is director of New Hanover County's Emergency Management and 911 Center. If you have your own question for our guests today on this Thursday, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline at WHQR.org. Just before we went to break, I asked about an unnecessary hypothetical because on this Thursday, there actually is a system that looks like it has a pretty good chance of formation swirling around in the Gulf of Mexico. Josh Weiss from the National Weather Service, can you tell us what we might expect?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a disturbance down in the southern Gulf of Mexico that the National Hurricane Center has put an 80% chance of development on, which means that in the next 2 to 5 days, there's an 80% chance it will become our first named system of the year, which I think is Alberto this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did I get that right? So Alberto could be developing in the Gulf of Mexico in the next couple of days. And while there's still a lot of uncertainty in the track, it looks like it will stay in the Gulf and not directly impact the Wilmington area. But unfortunately, we may have a pretty wet Memorial Day weekend coming up.
Stephen Still, so going back to this estimated arrival time of tropical storm force winds, let's just say, now we're getting into hypotheticals. Let's say Alberto forms. Let's say Alberto starts to travel up the East Coast. How soon, at what point are you in New Hanover County able to say, now we're getting a timeline on when tropical storm force winds could hit us?
It's a good question, and I hate to give this answer, but it depends. You know, something coming from the Gulf, coming from inland, is going to have different effects than something coming from truly from the Atlantic, where we're looking straight on shore effects. But let's say about 2 years ago, we just finished some studies with the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA on evacuation timing, you know, how long it would take to have a complete what we call clearance of New Hanover County. We broke it down into geographical areas. Previously, we were working on some very old census data. And so this new model takes into consideration existing road infrastructure and new road projects. It also takes into consideration Pender and Brunswick County because we evacuate into those two counties. So I will give you, with a hypothetical, I'll give you our worst case scenario. So I know with the entire population that we have and the infrastructure that we have in place for traffic, if we were having an Atlantic storm, I have 49 hours to evacuate New Hanover County before we would have arrival of tropical storm force winds. That's 2 days. That's a long time. So these new products, like Josh has, really helps us out. Now, I don't ever consider that we'll have a full New Hanover County evacuation. I don't know that that'll ever happen. It has not happened, at least in my history, or for some time. But we can drill it down into our problem areas. And with these new graphics, we can pinpoint and come up with a more reasonable evacuation timeline.
What are some of the problem areas?
Of course, the immediate coast. You know, New Hanover County is an island, with the exception of about an 8-mile stretch on the Pender County border. We're surrounded by either the Atlantic, Cape Fear, Intercoastal Waterway, Northeast Cape Fear. Any of those areas adjacent to the Atlantic, any of those inland areas that are adjacent to estuarine and riverine areas, but we also have a good number of low spots in New Hanover County. And neighborhoods, you know, up to 1,600 people that have to traverse a flooded road. So they're sitting high, but yet they have to drive through a flooded road. So we have to take those into consideration as well.
You said you don't think that New Hanover County has ever had a countywide evacuation. Explain evacuation orders to us. First of all, how do you make that decision? Under what circumstances would you say we need to evacuate some or all of the county?
Yeah, so we sit down with our control group, and it's our elected officials and county managers and individuals who have authority for their municipalities. And we look at the impact. So we don't take in consideration the categorization of the storm. We look at the anticipated impacts that we're going to see for this area. And evacuations are costly. They're dangerous. It's not something that we take lightly. And depending on who we're looking at to evacuate, there's all sorts of other implications if we're looking at hospitals or assisted living facilities. You know, if those locations are in an area that we have to evacuate, it takes a lot of time to do that. So we'll sit down with our control group. We'll look at the products that Josh and his folks prepare for us, and we will make a decision based on the timing that we have.
Now, are there different levels of evacuation order? I mean, are there times that you would say we recommend that people at the beach areas leave, but
yeah,
it's not mandatory, and then, you know, it's really not looking good. You probably should get out, and then, you know, get out now. Like, what are those levels, and how do you communicate those?
It depends on the timing. But, you know, generally, it's going to be a voluntary evacuation and then a mandatory evacuation, depending on the impacts. But, you know, I don't want to say that we err on the side of caution unnecessarily, because I think, you know, I have some numbers here in front of me, but Hurricane Harvey, you know, they had so many deaths attributed to people drowning in their car during evacuation. So we don't want to put people in harm's way unnecessarily. So we sit down and look at the true impacts of what we can expect and the amount of time that we have to get people out of that area, or if it's just safer for them to shelter in place during the effects.
You're listening to Coastline. We're learning today about the 2018 hurricane season, some new tools that are online. We're going to talk about why preparation is key to keeping life and property intact. Answering your questions on this Thursday, Stephen Still, he's New Hanover County's Emergency Management and 911 Director, and Josh Weiss, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Wilmington. You can call us during the live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Jesse from Wilmington asks, Josh, with the new storm surge products, can you tell about impending tidal waves or tsunamis?
So a tsunami and storm surge are vastly different. scientifically? And that's actually a really good question because a lot of people are confused about the differences. So storm surge is what we kind of call ocean runoff. It's all that water associated with the hurricane that's coming on shore, running over the dunes and into neighborhoods. And a tsunami is driven by something like an earthquake. It's a rapid rise and fall of the water level that has a similar run-up into neighborhoods, but they're caused by very different dynamics, very different phenomena. So tsunami and storm surge are very different. Now that being said, because the impacts can be similar, preparing for a tsunami and preparing for storm surge are kind of the same. You know, you're going to have water where it shouldn't be, water that can be life-threatening, water taking out homes and neighborhoods, and as Steve was saying, flooding out neighborhoods that may not even be impacted, but a lot of roadways could be washed out. So while they're very different, preparing for one or the other is important because preparing for a tsunami will make you ready for a storm surge as well during hurricane season.
Do we have tools in place that would warn us about a tsunami coming?
Absolutely, yeah. We actually will, not my office specifically, but there is the Joint Tsunami Warning Center that will issue tsunami warnings for the Atlantic coast should one happen. Now, that's not very likely in the Atlantic. It's more of a Pacific phenomena, but it can. In fact, the earthquakes that they had in Haiti not too long ago generated some minor tsunamis down that way, and there was a threat that they could come up this way. You know, very small, but it can happen here in the Atlantic, but it's rare. Storm surge from a hurricane is a much more likely phenomena to occur here than a tsunami.
And just last question about tsunamis. What kind of a timeline would we have in terms of how much lead time would we have if one were to come this way?
That can vary quite a bit. If you have an earthquake in Haiti that causes a potential tsunami here, you might only have 2 to 4 hours. But if you have a landslide in the Azores on the other side of the Atlantic, you could have 12 to 18 hours. But fortunately, there are a lot of tsunami buoys around the Atlantic Ocean that will alert us well ahead of time, and there should be plenty of time to evacuate if a tsunami were occurring on the North Carolina coast.
Stephen Still, from New Hanover County's website, it says, in recent years, the frequency and impact of natural disasters has increased, not because natural hazards occur more frequently, but because more people are choosing to live and work in locations that put them and their property at risk. While floods have caused a greater loss of life and property and have disrupted more families and communities than all other natural hazards combined, the rate of development in flood-prone areas continues to escalate, putting more people in danger. So much to unpack here. But first of all, can I just ask about that? The frequency and impact of natural disasters has increased not because the hazards themselves are happening more frequently, but because more people are living and working in areas that are prone to these kinds of events.
Yeah.
Really? I thought the science said, yes, there are more storms and they're more intense than they've ever been. Is that counter to the statement?
Unofficially, I've seen the information that says there are epochs of these events. It's an ebb and flow of severity of meteorological events. And from some of the data that I've seen, that we're at our statistical peak and we're starting to trail off. We're starting to go back down.
In terms of the number of events?
Number of events, correct. But as you mentioned, if nobody's there to witness a tsunami, nobody's there to feel the effects of that torrential rain for a period of time, then it's not necessarily an event with impact. So when we start increasing our numbers, then we will have more of those individuals who are affected by whatever it is.
And we are seeing, of course, a lot of development along areas that are prone to these types of events.
Absolutely.
So is the county saying that people shouldn't be building near the beach?
I don't think they're saying that. I don't know that I could even speak for that. A realtor would tell you it's all about the location. It's a beautiful place. That's why I live here. I grew up here. My family's been here for some time. And I choose to be here because of the location. But the things that give us the beauty and splendor all add to the hazard. So for everything that we have for us here in New Hanover County, there's a bit of hazard that goes with it.
We have a question from Bri, who writes, is there a reason why we here in Wilmington don't get tornadoes often during hurricanes? Josh Weiss.
I think that for the most part, people think in a city that they can't get a tornado, but absolutely we can get them here. And it just happens that we have been lucky, I guess would be the word to use. You know, when we had Hurricane Fran, which was 1996, and Hurricane Frances in 2004, there were quite a few tornadoes across the area. It just depends. In a hurricane situation, you need to be on the right front or the northeast side of the hurricane to have the best chance for tornadoes. And we just haven't been in that part of a hurricane really since Frances in 2004. So we haven't had a lot of tornadoes due to hurricanes in this area because of that. You know, knock on wood, fingers crossed, that continues. But Wilmington can absolutely get a tornado from a hurricane if the position of the storm was correct. And that would be, you know, kind of a landfall into Brunswick County or maybe even North Horry County in South Carolina would put us in that northeast quadrant of the storm, which is favorable for tornadoes in Wilmington.
It was just last month that a tornado tore through Guilford and Rockingham counties, and recovery and rebuilding efforts, of course, are still underway in those areas. But are there tornado hotspots in the Cape Fear region? And is it less likely that folks, say, at Wrightsville Beach would see a tornado? Is it impossible to have a tornado at the beach?
You can't use the word impossible about weather.
Okay.
<for anything.
laughs>
You know, let's start with that. But I can say two things about that. There actually is what we call a Carolina Tornado Alley, which there's been some research just in the past 5 to 10 years where the foothills up into the towards the coastal plain show an enhancement in frequency of tornadoes. I don't know if the understanding is there yet as to why that happens, but there's certainly an increase, you know, from I-95 west towards the foothills of North and South Carolina, where you get an increased number of tornadoes. Just, you know, we call it Carolina Tornado Alley. It's not like Tornado Alley in the Great Plains where they get these giant EF4s and EF5s all the time, but we do get an enhanced number of tornadoes here in the Carolinas. Now, as far as the beach goes, we don't usually get a lot, and the reason for that is actually pretty simple. We're all familiar with the sea breeze. The sea breeze is usually a stabilizing thing here, and that would kind of squelch or kill any strong storms that were approaching the coast. We saw that on April 16, 2011, where we had one of the worst tornado outbreaks in the coastal Carolinas. But by the time it got to Wilmington, it had really started to fall apart. And some of that is because that sea breeze is a stabilizing factor, and any storm that's approaching tends to fall apart. I know a lot of us meteorologists, we kind of get upset when we see that because we want, you know, I kind of want a big storm. You know, not a tornado, of course, but I get excited for the big storms. So when I see them approaching to the east and they start to fall apart because of the sea breeze, it's kind of a, you know,
it's a letdown for you.
I don't like to say that, you know, I don't want damage or anything, right. But I like, you know, this is what I live for. I love seeing, you know, the big storms. So when I see them fall apart, I know it's a good thing and it happens all the time. But the little kid in me gets a little bit upset because I've been doing this since I was a kid. So, but you can get a tornado at the beach. We had the Myrtle Beach tornado in 2001 that went right down the beach. I mean, it was an EF2, I think. There's some great video. It developed on the sea breeze and just went straight south down the beach for 2 or 3 miles. Incredible video, great tornado. So it can happen, but that sea breeze usually tends to inhibit tornadoes along the coast.
You're listening to Coastline. We're learning today about the 2018 hurricane season. We're going to talk in just a few minutes about preparedness and the new predictive tools that local leaders have access to this year. Answering your questions on this Thursday, Josh Weiss, he's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Wilmington, and Stephen Still, New Hanover County's Emergency Management and 911 Director. You can ask your own question during this live Thursday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1133 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Now, in the beginning of this discussion, we were talking about the forecast that just came out from NOAA. How does hurricane forecasting work? We always hear about phenomena like El Nino and La Nina, and aside from gender, what's the difference between those two factors, and how do they influence our Atlantic hurricane season?
Yeah, El Nino and La Nina are opposites of the same phenomena. And what that is a change in ocean temperatures along the equatorial Pacific, so off the coast of South America and across the Pacific Ocean. When you're in a La Nina, you have colder than normal ocean temperatures in that region. When you have an El Nino, you have warmer than normal temperatures in that region. And that is one of the main drivers of the seasonal hurricane forecast. And why that's important is because something like El Nino is so large that it affects the entire globe. And in the Atlantic, when you have warm ocean temperatures in the Pacific, you end up with what we call increased shear in the Atlantic, and that means you have increasing winds with height in the Atlantic Ocean. And what that does, it tends to tear apart storms as they try and develop. So if you have a hurricane trying to strengthen in the Atlantic, and you have very strong winds aloft, it'll kind of rip the tops of that storm off, and it won't be able to get its act together. You won't get a strong hurricane. So when you have an El Nino in the Pacific, you tend to have less than normal storms in the Atlantic because of that shear. Now, the reverse goes for La Niña. When you have cooler temperatures in the Pacific, you tend to have more storms and maybe stronger storms in the Atlantic because that shear is now weakened. And hurricanes don't like shear. They don't like strong winds. They want calm winds. They want, you know, a tropical paradise, warm waters, light winds. That's what hurricanes fuel off. And if you have that kind of condition in the Atlantic, you get a lot of hurricanes.
What do we have going on now?
Well, it's just came off of La Niña. Just in the past 2 or 3 weeks, we had a La Niña, very weak. It's now in the neutral phase. The current forecast is, and I guess I should explain neutral, means that there's pretty much near normal temperatures in the Pacific in that same region. The current forecast through the summer and through the fall is for a neutral phase becoming El Niño. So weekly, a weak El Niño, slightly above normal temperatures in the Pacific, which could be good for us because if we get an El Niño in the fall, peak of hurricane season is September 10th. If we get an El Niño during the fall, September, October, November, that could limit potentially the number and intensity of the storms that are developing
and that's
during
really
the peak
when,
of season.
That's when it's usually peaking
yes.
in terms of activity.
Yeah. The peak of the season in the Atlantic is September 10th, and we usually ramp up through beginning mid-August through middle of October is where we get most of our hurricanes.
And so then it's playing out, I guess, as you're explaining this, with the potential of Alberto before hurricane season even starts. That's reflecting the fact that we've got a La Niña?
Very possible. You know, it could be more active than normal early part of the season and then kind of tailing off a little during peak season. But as you said in the beginning, and as we want to say many times, it only takes that one. So whether or not we have below normal during peak season may not matter if we have another Matthew or another Fran.
And Stephen Still, we're just about to go to break, but tell us briefly, how do you think people in this region do when it comes to preparedness?
Yikes. I think it depends on the event. I'd say one of the things that we have working against us is complacency. We've had a lot of low events, tropical storms, low events. So I think it's been a while since we've seen something devastating.
And I'm going to ask you to pick up on that thought when we come back, and we will talk about specific ways to prepare before the season really starts. You're listening to Coastline. We're learning about hurricane season, preparing for catastrophic weather events with emergency management and 911 director Stephen Still and meteorologist Josh Weiss. When we come back from this break, more of your questions and comments. What do you want to know about how to get through this hurricane season? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today it's a conversation about the 2018 hurricane season, what you need to know to prepare. We're also going to take some shots at common misunderstandings around severe weather events. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Stephen Still, New Hanover County's Emergency Management and 911 Director, and Josh Weiss, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Wilmington. You can email us today at coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question in. It always takes longer than you think it will. And on that note, Oscar from Wilmington had called in and said, we had wind-driven rain damage to our house. The insurance company denied our claims because of this designation. Do you know what's going on here? Insurance companies getting out of paying with this damage designation. Stephen Still, what would you say to Oscar?
I'd say be familiar with your insurance plan. I know, and I'm fairly savvy, I can't understand mine. So unless I sit down with my agent and have them explain to me what is covered and what's not covered, I can't understand that from the paperwork that I have. It's a little confusing. It's cryptic. But I think, you know, before you go into a season, do that insurance review checkup with your agent to just know what is covered and what's not, and if you need to increase your policy.
And that's actually one of the points on your list for hurricane preparedness is checking out the specifics of your policy. But just before we went to break, Stephen, you were saying that you think we might have an issue with complacency here.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since we've seen a Fran Floyd Bertha. You know, for my family, we were almost a month without power in a northern part of New Hanover County. And it's not until you live like something like that do you have the urge, that sense of you need to prepare for something like that. When we have these ones and twos and tropical storms, your power goes out for an evening. There's not that heightened sense of awareness. You don't feel like you really need to put that much into it. And so we beat the drum of preparedness, have your kits ready. And some people may feel that, you know, it may be unnecessary to prepare all these things that have a shelf life perhaps, and that's going to go stagnant. So we're preaching loud about preparedness. You know, again, the storm season is looking near normal, but again, it just takes a small tropical storm for us to have extended power outages and effects. So, you know, we don't put too much consideration into the categorization. It's just the effects and
you're
making
saying
sure people understand them.
It really doesn't necessarily matter if we're talking about a Category 1 or a Category 5.
Yeah.
We could see other effects here that will cause power outages and all kinds of damage.
Yeah, on the face of 5 is way, way worse. But, you know, if you look at Superstorm Sandy, I think it made landfall as a 1. Widespread damages, deaths. So the categorization is important. I won't say it's not important, but we truly sit back and look at the National Weather Service here and look with our meteorologists and say, what impacts are we going to see locally? And we base our decisions off that.
Josh Weiss of the National Weather Service, getting information is one of the first points that you raised when talking about preparedness. How should people get information? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I always like to bring that up first, because if we issue a hurricane warning and you don't know how to receive that information, it's not going to help you out at all. So knowing how to get the information is important. The thing we recommend most is a weather radio. Having that weather radio is crucial, because all of our weather information will go out across that weather radio. And there's two good things about the weather radio. One, it's battery powered. So if we lose power for an extended period of time after a hurricane, you can still get your weather information. And two, and this is maybe the best thing about it, you can have it off, and if we issue a warning, it will trigger itself and turn on and alert you. So you can get your information even if you don't want that weather radio playing all the time. So it's reliable, it's immediate, it'll get your information to you. And while everybody has an app on their cell phone or they get those wireless emergency alerts, if the power's out for 2 or 3 weeks and the cell phone towers are down, that battery's not going to last 2 or 3 weeks. My battery lasts about 2 days right now. So you need this weather radio to be able to continue to get the life-saving information we provide. So the weather radio is number one. But those apps are good. They're very important on your phone. Working with, you know, the media, getting the information from the media is very important. Knowing your evacuation stuff from the emergency managers, working with the Red Cross, all of those agencies, we all work together to provide that life-saving information. So at least know how to get it is important. But we're always going to say the weather radio is number one.
What is the difference between a watch and a warning?
That's a great question. A lot of times we get confusion about that, so I do want to clarify. In terms of hurricanes, a watch means that within the next 48 hours, there is the potential for hurricane conditions locally. There's still some chance that it may veer off, may not happen, but it's improving chances that we are going to get hurricane conditions. We issue a hurricane warning when we are now within 36 hours of potential landfall or potential impacts, not landfall, but impacts, and there's high confidence now that we're going to see hurricane conditions. I think the best way to explain the difference is we're kind of using a cupcake reference now, in that a hurricane watch is like, or what we call a cupcake watch. You have all the ingredients to make cupcakes, but you don't actually have cupcakes yet. The hurricane warning is when you put all that together and now you have cupcakes. So that's the main difference. So hurricane watch means the ingredients are in place. You have all the ingredients, but you don't have the conditions. You don't have the cupcakes yet. The hurricane warning means the hurricane is happening. It is time to get to your safe place. Those cupcakes are in the oven. They're ready to be eaten.
You can smell them now, and
yeah,
that timer's going off at
exactly
any moment.
Right. We've all probably made or eaten cupcakes in our lives. We probably haven't all experienced a hurricane. So that's kind of the way we're using it right now. And I didn't come up with that. I can't take credit.
Oh,
I think it's a great
gosh
way to explain, you know, the difference between the watch and the warning.
That is one of the best analogies we've ever had on Coastline. You get credit as far as I'm concerned. We had a call, John from Wilmington. In the face of anthropocentric climate change, how will this change the scope and scale of our upcoming hurricane season? And I know, Josh, that this is, we actually got a question like this from Vince as well, which says, what if any relationship is there between climate change and the hurricane season? And This is a sensitive topic for the National Weather Service. So tell us about how the National Weather Service is handling that.
Yeah, absolutely. We get this a lot. You know, there is a lot of concern that global climate change is increasing the number of storms or making them worse. It's hard to say definitively that that is happening. And I'll say three things about it that I know that I can touch upon. One, there is a definite relationship between extreme rainfall events and a warming climate. We see that across the country. In fact, here in Wilmington, I think we've seen something like a 40% increase in 2-inch rainfall events since the 1970s, frequency of 2-inch rainfall events. So that is a clear signal to us. And that makes sense. If the climate is warming, it can hold more water. We can get more rain. But on the other hand, we are seeing right now, and Stephen alluded to it earlier, an increase in hurricanes recently, but that seems to be a multi-decadal cycle. In fact, as far as there's the El Nino, we also have an oscillation called the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. I'm not going to go into what that really is, but we see a clear connection between the number of hurricanes and the phase of this Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. We've been in the warm phase recently, and that means more hurricanes in the Atlantic. When we come out of this, which we should in the next 5 to 10 years, we expect to see a decrease in the number of hurricanes in the Atlantic. And we saw this back in the 70s and 80s. There weren't very many hurricanes. We were in the cold phase. Now we're warmed in the 90s and 2000s. We've had a lot of hurricanes. And you can even go back 50s and 60s, warm phase. We had Diana, we had Carol, we had Hazel. We had a lot of storms. We go back to the 20s, 30s, and 40s. There weren't as many. So there's a clear link between that as well. And the last thing is the satellite era is only from maybe the 1950s or so. We are able to see and identify a lot more storms now than we were even 50 years ago because the satellites pick up stuff in the middle of the Atlantic that nobody would have seen in the 1940s. So the increase in storms could be related to that as well. We're seeing a lot more because we have the technology to see them, whereas we didn't before. And even ships going across the Atlantic will now relay information to us, whereas in the 40s and 50s, they wouldn't be able to do that. So it's hard to say specifically whether or not anthropogenic enhancement of the climate is leading to stronger hurricanes and more hurricanes. There are some signals that there are. There are some signals that maybe there aren't. So it's really touchy to say that. But, you know, whether or not it is, we should always still be prepared. And that's the point of this, preparedness of hurricanes. Climate change is not going to change the fact that we still need to be prepared for when the hurricane does affect Wilmington.
Okay, so preparedness. We talked about making sure you have a weather radio and staying tuned. So you're not dependent upon a cell phone battery that can die in a couple of days and can't be recharged, perhaps. Stephen Still, what else do we need to do so that we can say, I've checked all the boxes and I'm prepared for hurricane season?
There's quite a few things that you can do, and they're quite simple things. I think it, I'm going to break out from the simple things that most everybody thinks they can do and try to allude into some other items that they may have not considered before. First, you know, New Hanover County goes through a hazard mitigation plan. So we learn what risks we have as a county. And so we would preach that to the individual. So what are your risks for you and your household and your location? What are your vulnerabilities? Are you yourself or your children dependent on certain medications that you may have problems finding in an event? Do you have to drive through? Is your house physically safe, but you have to drive through an area of floodwater? So that hazard risk identification that pertains to you and your family is important. So understand what your problems may be. And the whole develop a plan, I think people, like you said, are maybe tired of hearing that. But it's very important, and some people's plan may be simplistic, like, oh, I'll just call this person. But as Josh kind of mentioned before, if we're looking at a prolonged power outage, you may not have that ability to make that phone call out. You may not have a charge long enough to last. So look beyond the first couple of hours and think about a long-term plan that goes beyond electronics.
So if we're out of power for a week or two, that's unlikely these days, right?
But I wouldn't say unlikely. There's nothing when it comes to storms. I wouldn't say
nothing
anything.
Impossible, nothing unlikely. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to be out of power now for a couple of weeks. So I need to have an alternate way of communicating with my family.
Yeah, absolutely, and also consider, you know, reunification. If you know, if I go an extended period and my family haven't heard from me, then maybe there's a rally point that we should meet. Maybe there's someone that we should try to all get in contact with that's outside of really a hazard area that could be the holder of that information, our location. And you know, the plan goes, you know, deep into, you know, evacuation, anything that you can think of that pertains to your family's well-being. You know, go through your hazard risk plan and then put that into a plan how you prepared, how you're going to react when a storm or hazard occurs. And then third, I'd say is assemble your supplies. You know, that varies here of what you consider that's important to you. You know, as we talked to you earlier about insurance, so having that insurance information protected in a box, but also have that the food and the water for extended power outages.
Frozen pizzas are good.
Yeah, for about 20 minutes or your microwave goes out. And I'll say this because I have children, is that you've got to consider their well-being and your well-being if they're not occupied for a period of time. I know when Netflix goes out for a period of time, parents are going to lose that ability to control their children. So if I have a hyperactive child, let's say he's 3 years old, like my son, and I don't have a way to keep him occupied while I'm taking care of my home, taking care of my neighbors, et cetera, if I don't have a plan for him, then I'm going to have an issue. So making sure that your children and your pets too, you know, my mother and father consider their dogs more family than maybe me. I don't know that they would evacuate to miss their dog's 3 o'clock ice cream social. But, you know, their pets are just as much as family as anybody else. So you have to have those considerations. Do you have medication for them? Do you have food for them? Can you physically, you know, relocate them?
Can you talk for a minute about preparing a home? You know, we always see video of people in Florida when there's a system on the way boarding up windows. And is that actually effective?
It depends on your location. You know, there's lots of things that you can do to prepare your home. And some of them are very simple. You know, taking down your wind chimes, that could be, you know, a projectile for your neighbors. You know, the smallest things, your chairs, your tables, the lighter stuff that could be windborne debris, you know, locking that stuff up. If you're in a flooded area, an area that's routine to flooding, you know, sandbags may be efficient to keep water out. A sump pump may be efficient to keep water out. But there's small things that you can do for your home that it depends on the event, wind, rain, that you can do to protect a structure, structural protections. And I guess go ahead.
Well, so structural protections, communication plans, putting a kit together with medication, food, water, that sort of thing, making plans for your animals. Can you talk for a moment about shelters?
Yeah, absolutely. So for New Hanover County, we have 4 shelter sites for storms, and we have another shelter site for radiological events. But if we were to have a storm, we do provide a safe harbor for individuals who are in areas that are prone to either wind debris or flooding debris to come shelter out the storm with us in one of our schools. We have a partnership with New Hanover County Schools. And so we take that in consideration with our evacuation decision is getting people into a shelter at the same time prior to arrival of tropical storm force winds, get them in, get them registered, get them situated, and have them there for the duration of the storm. And then after the storm, our sheltering numbers actually increase.
Now, at what point can and should people call 911, and under what circumstances do they often do that when they shouldn't during a storm?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If we have an activation of our EOC, our Emergency Operations Center, we activate a line called EPIC. It's Emergency Public Information Center. We have Spanish interpreters. We have language line capabilities if you're non-English speaking to get information that's storm or event specific that's non-emergency. So if you do not feel it's an emergent, if you do not need immediate response, then we would urge people to use that EPIC line. It's posted on our website. It's only active if the EOC is active. But if it's a true emergency, absolutely call 911. And if you're unsure, call 911 and we'll figure it out together.
Now, I just have to get this in. We always see people running to the beach when a hurricane is getting close. Josh Weiss, is that a good idea? We often don't see waves like that on the East Coast.
No, do not go to the beach when there's a hurricane approaching. That's an easy answer right there.
That's this edition of Coastline. Josh Weiss, Stephen Still, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. Find it on the WHQR app or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.